Welcome to The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, and also author of Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensic Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. Today on The Wildlife, I'll be joined by Pierre Fidenzi, president of Endangered Species International, also known as ESI. We'll talk about how ESI works to protect the forgotten endangered species that are ignored by most other organizations, and also find out about his work in the Philippines, where ESI has programs to save the Philippine forest turtle and also to stop dynamite fishing in the coral reefs. But first, let me play you today's creature call. This week's creature call is the sound of a kind of reptile that lives in the hottest, driest areas in Africa, just south of the Sahara Desert. Now listen carefully and see if you can guess today's creature call. At the end of the show, I'll play these sounds again and tell you what kind of animal made them. Now, let me turn to my conversation with Pierre Fidenzi. Pierre Fidenzi is the founder and president of Endangered Species International, a conservation organization supporting projects worldwide, including in the Democratic Republic of Congo, India, the Philippines, Borneo, and Colombia. ESI works with many species largely unknown to the public and ignored by other conservation organizations. For instance, today we'll hear about ESI's work with the Philippine forest turtle. The Philippine forest turtle is one of the most endangered turtles on Earth and is currently found on only two islands in southern Philippines. ESI is conducting surveys to localize the remaining wild populations in order to establish core conservation areas of this endemic and rare turtle. At the same time, it is aggressively conducting innovative conservation awareness programs. Further, ESI is working with those who illegally collect the Philippine forest turtle to help them find alternative sources of income, like ecotourism, so that instead of capturing the animals, they'll choose to protect this endangered species instead. Pierre Fidenzi was born in southern France, and at an early age, he was already involved in discovering, studying, and protecting nature. He quickly developed a special interest in amphibians and reptiles and actively participated in various wildlife research and conservation programs. At the age of only 20, Pierre started Las Baulas National Park Project in Costa Rica, something we'll talk about today. At that young age, he'd also already won multiple environmental awards. More recently, he has received conservation awards from the BP Conservation Program, the Turtle Conservation Fund, and the Sophie Danforth Conservation Biology Fund. With passion and expertise, he has developed and directed conservation projects in South, Central, and North America, as well as in Southeast Asia and Europe. His areas of expertise include amphibians and reptiles, applied conservation, biological surveys, and community-based projects. He's also a member of the IUCN Species Survival Commission. As you listen to our discussion, you'll see a constant refrain about how to achieve success in conservation. Namely, Pierre Fidenzi steadfastly believes that to achieve sustainable conservation of endangered species, you must address the needs of the people that live within the habitat, especially those that also relate to the needs of the species that you want to protect. When we spoke recently, I asked him how he first got interested in wildlife and endangered species.
I started to be fascinated by animals at the early age, just the curiosity. So I was playing a lot outside, and basically at the age around 11, 12, I was already, walking through the creeks or through the forests in southern France, looking for snakes, frogs, birds. Just observations, and I was taking notes, and then trying to understand what was around me, and basically I got this love for animals at the early age by going outside.
And did you study animals in school or biology?
I did study biology, yes. At school, and I did also my bachelor was biology, and my master's was also in environmental science and biology.
Oh,
but
really?
For me, the education is it was not what really made me who I am. It's mostly my field curiosity that started all everything.
Interesting. And then I know in your bio it says that by the age of 20, you'd already won multiple environmental awards. And I wanted you to tell me a little bit about that, because it shows a lot of your interest in what you were doing.
Right. Well, first, I was very, very curious and very fascinated by the rainforest. So I really wanted to do a project for in the tropical country. So basically, I did create a project at the age of 20, raise the money, get some grants and some honors, and then went with 7 volunteers from France and also with the Costa Rican volunteers, and I created that project in Costa Rica to reinforce Las Baulas National Park. It's a national park in the Pacific coast of Costa Rica. And that's that first project was very rewarding for me because well, it took me 3 years to start a project. I went first to Costa Rica by myself before the age of 20 to see, and I met people, and I got also the support of the environmental ministry of Costa Rica. And when I went back, they were very surprised, actually, that me, at that age, I was already, I was keeping my words first, but also I came back with the funds and the people. And I was the youngest even in the team I created, because I took people that were older than me. And it was very interesting because I was even invited to some of the meetings with the Ministry of the Environment at that time. And so that was very interesting because I was very young, and I've learned so much through that experience, of course. And it was a fascinating experience.
Now, Las Baulas National Park is on the Pacific coast of Costa Rica, and it's one of the few remaining sites in the world of significant leatherback turtle nesting activity. Is that why you concentrated on that region, or were there other attractions to that place?
That's correct. Right. Yeah. The reason you just mentioned, that's why, and then especially at that time when I went there, it was still the beginning of the development. When I say development, it's tourism development within the area of Las Baulas. There was a lot of sale of lands, a lot of potential impact, beginning of already of impact, and there was a lot of issues. And also, I was also interested in the mangrove because there's a mangrove on the back. That is actually pretty big, and so that was the project was also including the mangrove and also the nesting area for the turtles. But the project was not only about trying to protect the turtles, but also we did a lot of scientific outputs. We also created some signboard awareness, improve awareness a little bit, and provided also equipment to the park, because at that time they didn't even have binoculars, the rangers.
Oh, really?
But it's pretty hard for rangers even to spot, you know, illegal people trying to take the eggs from the nesting site.
When was this that the park was established?
Well, I think the establishment was in 1995, if I'm correct. It's one of the latest, actually, parks to be established in Costa Rica, one of the latest. But I'm not sure if it's 94, 95, but I think it's around that area, that time, yeah.
And then have you been back there to see it? I was reading just recently that there was some debate about, it was a little unclear about the status because there was some proposed development in that region. And some debate.
Correct,
about
right.
It.
Yeah, there's a lot of there's a lot going on there. I came back 3 years later to see what we did, because I wanted to see the results 3 years later. What was left? What was how the rangers also still apply what they've learned and so on. I wanted to see also if the binoculars, as a stupid, very a simple example, will still be used and working. So I came back there and I was very pleased with some of the results, because even the signboards we created, and we did a lot of painting and things like that, were still there. So I was very happy with that. However, there was a lot, much more pressure coming in from the outside for tourism and uncontrolled tourism. And that was already showing sign of a lot of tensions between the government, the private sectors, the NGOs. And as far as I've read recently, now the government would like to think is not, there's some land. The park basically is too small. It's basically, you know, the nesting area and the mangrove, but basically the rest is not protected. So the government would like to buy some of the land to make it you know, more better protection on the land side of the park, but the land belongs now to private owners mostly, and the price is so high that the government is not doesn't want to put the money to buy it.
Okay.
So the NGOs are trying to find some money, but it's so high the price of the land that basically probably nobody is going to be able to buy it, and at this point we might lose the park itself, because if we don't protect the land that is next to the beach, it's probably a lost cause already.
Did that experience, or were there others as well, that prompted you to establish your own organization, which is called Endangered Species International, which you're also the president of?
Well, that experience, actually, after I finished the project, I had some bitter experience, too. Not everything is great.
But you learn a lot from the bitter ones. So tell me about that.
I learned a lot. And I was not really interested in creating an NGO at that point, I preferred at that time to focus on project, but just with a few individuals, and not having larger groups, and then the NGO come later after working as a biological consultant in California. I was getting not happy, I should say, with the way I was using my time. I really wanted to do that was on my heart, which is basically make a difference in this world, and the difference will be for me towards wildlife and in the environment. So then I decided to create Endangered Species International, because also I was not very happy with the experience I had in the past with other NGOs, because I was also volunteers for many years for other NGOs.
So tell me about Endangered Species International. You know, what is it, what's its primary mission, and how is it different from other NGOs where you didn't have a good experience?
Well, ESI, or Endangered Species International, the goal of the NGO is to reverse the trend of species extinction. So we want to stop the extinction of species and try to also reduce the numbers of endangered species through also protection and conservation of the habitat. Now, how I envision Endangered Species International was also, I wanted to make sure that everybody that is involved ESI would know the ground very well.
Why is that?
Because in the past, when I was working for other NGOs, sadly I discovered very quickly that many decisions were made by offices, even sometimes called local or regional offices, but were still the decisions were not what I thought, and probably also I think from what I got, the local communities wanted. The decisions were very far off from the reality in the ground. So by creating ESI, I really wanted, that's the goal at the beginning, to have everybody with a really, really good experience in the field, and especially in the experience in the field where we are working.
So what's that mean in practice?
So most of the people, if we have a project, let's say, like the case of Congo, where we have a project with the gorillas, all, most of the people working in the project are from Congo and are from the area exactly where the gorillas are hunting, where the problem is. So basically, we're trying to pull the people, you know, from the problem, you know, where they live in, and put them into the our group.
Okay, so that is very unique because most NGOs don't have that.
Right, and again, it's not an easy process. Because it takes a lot of time, you know. For example, for me to start a project, or if somebody we decide to start a project, I need to go to the field and meet everybody, and it might take 2 or 3 years before we start a project, because I want to make sure that we have the right people from the area.
So, what habitats or species does ESI concentrate on?
Well, to be honest with you, most of the species that we are working on, focusing on, most of the other NGOs are not interested in. However, we still have, for example, like I just mentioned earlier, a project on gorillas. So that's, we're not the only ones, obviously. But, for example, when we work on some species of frogs, that's probably, we are the only ones. I mean, it's pretty obvious. Nobody else work on that in the field. It could be even mouse deer. You know, we have a project on hold right now, but on the mouse deer, we are the only one also. So we are trying to focus on some species that are in the brink of extinction, but also species that we know that we can achieve some results, because there's also many cases where the fight against extinction is too difficult, or it's almost a lost cause. So it's a waste of resources. So we are trying to make sure that where we're going to spend our time and resources, we want to see some positive results within the next few years.
So that calculus enters into your decisions about where to work?
That's also take part of our decisions, why we decide, okay, we're going to choose that species. Of course, we would like to have a species that has, can be used as an umbrella for many other species, and for also different type of habitats.
And I know you do a lot of work in the Philippines. In fact, that's where you are physically right now.
That's right.
And so I'd love to focus for a little bit on the Philippines and have you tell me, what are you doing there?
Well, the Philippines started, the reason why I came the first time to the Philippines, that was because of my interest on turtles, on freshwater turtles.
Are there a lot of organizations working on freshwater turtles?
Once again, there's not that many organizations who focus or have projects on freshwater turtles.
What species of freshwater turtle are you looking at?
There is a species of freshwater turtles that is found only in one part of the Philippines, which is within the Palawan island group. And this species of turtles is called the Philippine forest turtle. And it's found only in creeks and swamp pond type habitat. So that's the first the reason why I went there the first time, to look for that species, because the species was never found in the wild yet at that time. It was already known from museum specimen in the U.S. and in Manila. So there was a lot of blurry where that species was found in the Philippines.
And how did how did you even know it existed?
Well, we had somebody found a specimen, a live specimen, at a farmer's market in the Philippines, in Palawan.
Oh, really?
And and he took that picture, and so that was the first confirmation that species was still alive. It was still somewhere in the Philippines. So I went to this island where the person saw it accidentally, actually, in the market, and went in the field in habitat that I really thought that would be suitable for that species of turtle based on the descriptions of the museum specimens. So I went to look at slow-moving creeks, and I went also into a lake in the area, and I see my first specimen into the shallow part of the lake. So it's more like a marshland type, and that turtle is mostly active during the night.
Oh, really? So how did you find it?
Well, you know, I had this interest for turtles for quite a while, and I knew already that most of the freshwater turtles in the tropics are only active at night. So even if you go during the day in a place where there's plenty of turtles, you will not see anything. So you have to go at night with flashlights and then swim, maybe sometimes even put some baits to attract animals to particular areas. And spend a lot of time at night looking for turtles under the water.
So you're in the water physically looking for turtles.
Yes, because many times you have to search for turtles that are hidden under the rocks or branches, and because they're not always moving around.
And then what? How did you feel when you saw that turtle? Did you know immediately that it was the Philippine forest turtle?
I knew it immediately based on the museum specimens that was the one. I was very, very happy. I must mention something. The first one I saw, that was a dead one. That was the one that was eaten by a local. That was just the carapace, the shell left. So that's my first encounter. And then after that, I knew that this turtle was going to be in that particular area. And when I saw my first one, I was extremely happy, of course.
And then a lot of times, I know for other species, when something that was thought to be extinct or not even known to exist is discovered, that it leads to increased demand for it because it's special and rare. Did that happen with this species? Because it was thought to be extinct until these live specimens were found.
That's correct, and actually that's what happened. Since it's I would say rediscovery in the wild, at least to the science, a lot of live specimens have been shipped to Europe and Japan, and even now to the US, and sold as a pet. A specimen of that species is usually sold overseas around $1,500 to $2,000 a piece.
Oh, really?
Yes.
And then what makes it so attractive?
You mean as far as for the people who want to trade it illegally, or as far as the biologists?
Actually, both, because I'm interested in what makes it attractive in the marketplace, but also, you know, what is special about this species?
Well, for the market, if it's very rare, people will pay it a lot of money. So that's just the thing. It's not a turtle that is particularly good looking, I should say. It's not, of course, she has a very, very special shape, and she has a yellow ring. I should say around the neck, yellow, pale, light yellow, line around the neck. That's a special feature. However, that's a turtle that is spending most of her time under the water. It's nocturnal, so is only active at night. So, in the standpoint of a pet owner, it's not really that attractive, but what attracts them is the value. Since it's very, very rare, it has a high value, and that's the only reason. So people are really ready to pay a lot of money for that. Now, as far as a biologist, for me, what was intriguing me is to learn more about that species. It's very simple. And then to learn about its natural history, the habitat, and how much, how many are left in the wild since it's an endangered species.
And
what can we do to protect it? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then how many are there left in the wild? Do you know?
Well, we don't know. We don't have a number yet. What we know for sure is the population is declining. There's no question with that. There's some sites where, for example, the first site where I saw the species, now it's extremely difficult to Galaxy One. So this site was totally people went there and took hundreds of turtles and sold them overseas and also to the domestic pet market. So we know that based on illegal trade that occurred for the last 6 years, we know that a lot of turtles have been sold overseas. However, we don't know yet how many turtles are left in the wild, because we still need to define the exact places where all the turtles are found. We know already, we have a good idea, but we still need to know to do more assessment for exact locations where all the populations are found. However, the range of the species is so small that it's very easy to inflict a population decline within 10 years just by harvesting turtles, even though we don't have, let's say, habitat destruction.
And so really, I was going to ask what the major threats are. So really, it sounds like it's harvesting of the turtles that's a major threat, more so than habitat destruction?
That's correct. That's correct. Habitat destruction is a second threat, but it's not the major, since the area where the turtles are found, we have people living near there, but they are just low income farmers or hunters, or they don't really inflict too much threats to the creek. The main threat as far as habitat is concerned, it's deforestation, and sedimentation, and losing some of the banks along the creek. However, that's still a low threat in comparison to harvesting.
And then, can you describe the habitat? You said it's a very small range, so it lives in a very circumscribed area. How big is that range?
And well, the range is about 150 kilometers long, and wide it's about 80 kilometers. Now, of course, within this range, there's a lot of gap with no turtle at all. The turtles are only found in aquatic habitat. They need creeks and certain type of creeks. For example, a river will not apply. It will not be a good habitat. You will never find that species in a river. There's too much flow. Maybe there's too much rocks. They need murky and very the substrate has to be very easy for them to hide underneath. So, for example, if you have a very muddy bottom, that's good for them. They don't use usually rice paddies. That's also not good. Some of the species of fresh of turtles will use rice paddies. There are rice paddies, of course, in the Philippines. So that's not an increase in habitat for that species, unfortunately. They seem to stay only in creeks, use the upland habitat. We don't know yet how far they go. It's very unclear, but definitely they do use the upland habitat, especially when the creeks dry during the dry season. So that's pretty much the idea.
And then the laws, you had said that it's illegal trade. What are the laws for this species?
So basically, this species is protected in the Philippines. So if somebody wants to catch it and sell it, it's basically totally illegal. It's illegal. However, as probably you know, enforcement of laws on those countries is almost inexistent. So basically, it's very easy to trade endangered animals and sell them to the domestic market and also to the international market. Now, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, so is there a domestic market, and where do when the animals are harvested or collected, where do they go? Do they go to Manila?
That's correct. The domestic market is Manila. There is a big pet market in Manila, and they are sold over there. It's also a transit area for overseas. So also the local, the some of the locals in Manila, the Filipinos do buy that turtle because it's a rare item. Now it's not as sold as it used to be, because now in Manila, people, the people who sell that species are aware that it's illegal, so they hide them on the back of the market. So it's more for special orders, I should say, or people who are really looking for that species, and they will go to that particular pet market, pet store, and ask for that species, and they will have it in the back of the market, or they will order some, and they can get them within 2 or 3 weeks.
Now, how, so, I was going to say, how did you learn all this about the markets? I know ESI does a lot of monitoring of markets undercover, it seems like.
That's correct. I did some actually of the studies, the undercover studies in Manila. And the reason why I did that is because it's very easy for me, because I am a tourist. However, if I would do the same thing in Congo, I'll just mention again with the gorillas, because we did a lot of also undercover markets with the gorilla meat, that would not work. You know, it's very difficult to do undercover studies as a foreigner in Congo. But in Manila, in the Philippines, it's very easy. They associate me with a really good and potential buyer. So basically, they will show me all their turtles very easily. Of course, you know, I have to play the game, and I think I can do pretty well with that. But if I would send, for example, one of our local guy over there, and he would ask for that particular species, they will have some doubt. They will say, maybe this guy is working for the government, or they will not. They will say, oh, probably this person doesn't have money, and it's too risky to show the turtles. But if you go as a foreigner, they will show you the turtles more. Very easy for them, I mean, to be more respondent and open.
Do you still monitor the markets now?
Okay, we still, yes, I still monitor the market. As a matter of fact, I went there less than a month ago, and I could not see any turtles of this species in the market. However, there was just a shipment that was sold just a week before I was there, and then the guy that I talked to told me that he was gonna get his new shipment within 2 weeks. So basically, they're still selling them within Manila, and then also you can find them in the Chinese market, which is they're cheaper and they have them in a more permanent basis, I should say.
And what is the attraction in the Chinese market?
Well, in the Chinese market, they also sell them as a pet. However, it's possible, but I couldn't document that they would also, some of the Chinese will buy that for traditional Chinese medicine, as they do in China with other species. But there is no indication of that, so I cannot say that at the moment, but they sell them officially as a pet. But the price is definitely lower than as the pet stores in the other part of Manila.
And then some people would say that having the species, you know, as a pet, that helps the conservation of the species because, you know, they're cared for perhaps better than in the wild with all the dangers.
Well, in this case, and in general, what triggered the problem is the pet market and those ones who have the species at home. To have few specimens at home, that will not help the species for a simple reason that even, for example, if they can bring them, we might not be able to release them in the wild because of some maybe introducing some disease to the wild populations. Also, we don't know how they will adapt in the wild if you release those specimens. Right now, we need to focus on the ground where we know we have left populations. We need to protect those populations, the habitat, and all of that with strong support of the locals who live in the area. If we do not have the strong support of the locals, it's thoroughly a failure of the project. And which means also that this project should be the project of the local. It should not be the project of a local NGO. It should be the project of the local living in the area.
And so how is ESI facilitating that? You know, what are you doing to help protect the turtles?
Well, the first things that we need to do is to make sure that we convey the message and educate the people about the turtles, about the environment, conservation, all these issues. So the first thing is conservation awareness and education. There is a huge lack of awareness in this field, so we have to do a lot of work on that. The second thing is when the people are aware and agrees to conserve and to protect these species or any other rare animals, we need immediately try to find some ways for them to make money, because people catching the turtles are not bad people. They are people like you and me. They have a family. They want to eat, and to sell those turtles, it's in some cases one of the last resorts they have to survive. So we have to also to understand the side of the story and their life. So the second thing we need to do is to find, like as I said, some local alternative. How can we supply, give them a new job, and at the same time stop going into the field and collecting turtles?
And how can you? What are some of the alternatives available?
Right. So now the alternative, there's many alternatives possible. Then the people, you know, can change, of course, their income by doing. Just give you an example. Let's say agriculture, organic farming. That could be an example. Then, but that's also a long-term project because it implies a lot of trainings, and there's a lot of phases into it. And once the project starts, we need also to make sure that the people that used to catch for the turtles become a little bit, I should say, the protectors of the turtles. So they will be the one also watching on the creeks once in a while, talking to the communities to make sure there's no other outsiders coming by and going to the creek and illegally catching specimens, because it's not always the people living in the area. You have sometimes some outsiders that know that they can make a lot of money very fast by going into the creek. So different alternatives. For example, I'll just give you another one. If you say to a family or a group of house, okay, what if I give you some electricity through the use of solar panels, and in exchange, you're gonna start to protect a certain section of the creek. So which means, of course, you don't have to do work in every day, like, for example, planting trees and things like that, but at least you are the guard of the area to make sure that nobody goes into the creek and illegally catch turtles. Yeah. People are still allowed to go to the creek and fish for their food, and even some people still continue catching turtles, other species actually, for food, because some locals do eat freshwater turtles too.
And has that been successful?
Well, it's still that phase is still the beginning, because what we have done in the past, it's really try to understand where the turtles are. That was our main concern, and how also the illegal trafficking works. And at the same time, also try to really understand the habitat, where the turtles are found, are they moving far away from the water, and so on. So now the next phase, that's the phase we're trying to engage right now, is to work with the people in the field, and then to have them to become the one who's going to protect those populations. Now, It's not an easy task because, of course, that takes a long time. And also, when I said take a long time to see the results, the result will be, okay, we don't have a population decline anymore. We have a population increase, or at least the population is not declining. That will take a while. And also, we have to face with the realities of the ground, which is political and environmental. There's a lot of also factors that make the things slow, I should say.
And then how do you, you know, to collect that information that we were just talking about understanding where the turtles are, and we've talked a little bit about the undercover work to gather information about how the trade's working, but how, I know here in the U.S., we've all been participating recently in the U.S. population census, so how do you survey turtles and, you know, find out where they are?
Well, first of all, like as I said earlier, you have to go at night with the team of biologists, I should say, and there's different ways. The first one is we can put traps. So we put traps in the creek with baits, usually funnel traps, and the bait it's a piece of meat or a piece of fish that will attract the turtles. To go inside, and that's the first one of the first methods. The second one is to walk, transect, or to walk within the creek, and then looking within the creek. So that means using your hands under the logs, under the mud, and then looking like if you're looking for some coins or something hidden somewhere. In many cases. The creek gets very deep, so we cannot walk anymore, and it's too murky, too muddy to even see through with a mask. And therefore, in those cases, this is where we use the funnel traps at night, the deep pools. The area that are not deep, we do walk and then search with binoculars, looking for turtles moving around, looking for food, and so on.
And then do you tag them at all?
Okay, so you can also, yes, you can mark them if you want to know better the population structure, the population size, and also if they move, let's say, from one creek to another one. So marking them is definitely a plus, and turtles should be marked, yes.
And what do you mark them with? Or do they choose their own names?
All right. Well, for all the turtle project that we had in the past, basically we use a simple method that has been used a long time by all the biologists. It's on the shell, the top of the shell is called the carapace. We put a little notch on the edge of the shell. And basically, the age of the shell has marginals. We call that marginals. It's like, not exactly how to describe it, but it's a clear distinction within the shell. So each clear distinction has a specific number. We give 1, 2, 3, and we can give a number. We can give up to, you know, for the same population, we can go up to 10,000 individuals. We can go very far. And the marking is permanent, but if we encounter, for example, very young turtles, then we cannot mark them. It's too young. They're too young, and they won't be permanent anyway.
And what is too young?
Well, too young meaning usually I would say up to maybe 3 to 5 years when they're still between the hatching period until 5 to 6 years maybe maximum.
If you didn't physically mark the animal, is there any other way to tell them apart? I mean, I know like when you watch whales, you can tell individual whales just from the markings on the tails and the notches on the tails. Is there something similar in these turtles, or no, not really? You have to mark them physically.
You have to mark them. I mean, the carapace, the coloring changes through the age. the shape changing also a little bit. Now, that's the only way. It's impossible otherwise. Even if you take pictures of the carapace, the bottom of the turtles, over the years it will change. That's the only way.
And then are you also working to protect this area? Because the habitat is so small, does that make it easier to protect them or to try to establish a specific protected area?
Well, some of the populations are already within protected area. That does not mean that they are protected, because we also have information that within the protected area, turtles have been caught illegally. So thinking that we already have a protected area, we are safe, it's totally wrong. We have to change our mentality. Even to have a protected area doesn't mean that the population is protected. Therefore, yes, it's essential to have critical habitat protected for that species, for the habitat, protect the habitat. But it will not protect the population, the individuals. Therefore, we come back to the same issue we had before, which is let's find some ways for those catching turtles illegally to make some money and stop catching them. And that's the main thing.
And then can you talk about any other projects that you've worked on, you know, where you had the similar issues of needing to create alternative incomes and you ended up with a success story? I guess my big question is, you know, what have been some of ESI's success stories?
Well, I'm going to start to say first that to get a success story, you need to address the needs of the people who live within the habitat of the species that you're working, or all the animals, or if you're just focusing on a special habitat and so on. So the needs, of course, there's many type of needs. Now you need to focus on the needs that also relate to the species that you want to protect. So in every project, we address the needs of the people. So basically, we have to talk to the people, we organize meetings and so on, and try to understand how we could protect that species together. And at the same time, they could get some benefits, because, of course, the people want to see benefits. And when I say benefits, it's financial benefits. The people who live in remote areas or even in big cities are not going to protect something if they don't see something in return. That's the way it is. So we have to face that. They're not going to do that work, because for them it's work, for free. Even though if they consider the species rare, even if they consider the species as maybe it's only endemic to one particular area, so that make it very special for the people. It could be used as a flagship species for the area. But it's still not enough. At some point, we have to address that. So to give you a success story, it's not easy, because ESI, it's a recent organization, and then we have to be honest in the sense where a success in most of the time will take many, many, many years. If somebody, another organization, tell you, yes, we got a success within a year, I will not call that a success. I will just call that just a step, because it will take a long time before we can reach our final goal. The final goal is to protect specials, that species is really well protected for the future generation, and the habitat is fully protected, and the people living in the area are also benefiting from our conservation awareness, and then everything is okay together. So basically, if you ask me an exact success story, that to say at the same time that we don't have yet because we're too young, but at the same time, made a lot of progress, I agree. Uh-huh.
Yeah, when was ESI, when did you establish ESI?
ESI was created in 2006.
Oh, that's so very recent.
That's very recent, exactly. Yeah. We have grown very fast, but that's even if you have, let's say, 100 people working with you, that's huge. You have already achieved what you want to achieve.
I want to talk just very, very briefly about also, since you're in the Philippines now, your work to stop dynamite fishing. And if you can tell listeners, you know, what is dynamite fishing to start with?
Well, surprising enough, dynamite fishing is still occurring nowadays. Many people thought that was an old issue, but locals are still using dynamite fishing to provide fish, basically. So dynamite fishing, it's a very simple method. It's a fast method. They basically dynamite the ocean, the area where the coral reefs are, because this is where all they have the highest concentration of fish. So they use dynamite fishing in those areas, but also in open areas, but usually within coral reef areas. And then in just instantly, you have all the fish dead and appearing at the surface of the water, and some of them still floating underneath, and then just gather the fish. Now, with dynamite fishing, it's not as used as it used to be, which means that there is less people using dynamite fishing. Now, a lot of people are the victim of dynamite fishing nowadays also. So dynamite fishing, yes, still people are using it, but nowadays in the Philippines, and not only in the Philippines, Indonesia, Malaysia, we have a lot of fishermen, local fishermen, who are the living victims of the past dynamite fishing. So we need to address those issues as well, because a huge part of the fishing population, people fish, the fishermen, are those are victims of that. And when I mean the victims, I mean the people living, trying to survive fishing without using any more dynamite fishing, but cannot survive basically enough, they cannot have enough fish to survive.
For these fish, is it used to sell for in commercial trade, or is it used just to eat from the fishermen who are using dynamite fishing?
So to eat and mostly to sell it.
And is there a way to tell, you know, when a fish that's been sold had been caught with dynamite fishing, or does it look just the same as one who's been caught, you know, through nets or some other means?
It's easy to make a difference. You can see the body shape, and also I'm not sure the term in English. Now I'm having an English trauma, but in French would be the tampon. I don't know what to say in English. Anyways, there is towards the face, you can see that there's some damage. So it's very easy to analyze that if you have a little bit of experience and see that the fish was caught by dynamite fishing, cyanide fishing, or in a regular net, or by hook. You know, you can make a difference.
And then, how can you stop this practice?
Well, this practice has been used for such a long time. That is not something that's easy to stop. And also, we are dealing with a lot of corruption, because even some of the local politicians are using dynamite fishing, or are the main middlemen buying those fish and then selling them back to, let's say, Manila. So there is also a lot of corruption with dynamite fishing that we have to deal with. But it's very difficult to stop. Now, most of the fishermen realize very quickly that dynamite fishing is not a long-term fishing practice. After a few years, the era is completely over, so there's no more fishing there. People cannot even put a hook or a fishing net. All the fish is gone. The coral reef is gone. It's a disaster. So they will go and do the same thing further away and further away. So basically, of course, conservation awareness is the main thing. There's also some health issue with dynamite fishing, because it's a very dangerous fishing practice. I have met many fishermen who have lost their arms, or even their, in the best case scenario, I should say, just their hand. So there's also, you know, some health issue with that. But basically, to try to explain to them, okay, it's not a long-term alternative. You might make some money for 1 or 2 years, and that will be it. That's the part. And also, we come back to again to the alternative livelihood for the locals, because some of the families nowadays, even if they go fishing using nets, they will not make enough money. They will probably fish 1 or 2 fish in a day, and it's just enough to feed the family. So they need to find other alternative, compensate the lack of income because there's no more fish in the ocean.
And what are some alternatives that might be available?
Of course, it depends of the area. Every it has to be specific to a local area, but it could be aquaculture, say even trying to raise a certain type of fish farming, like grouper. Those type of fish are very well praised in the market. It could be crab farming. And also some of the fishermen will actually be happy not to fish anymore. And that's something that also not many people don't know. They would prefer to do another job because fishing is a very, very tough job. They have most of the time wake up at 4 in the morning, depending on the tide. They leave very, very early. They leave around 5 o'clock, 5 p.m., and come back the next day around 10 in the morning. And they cannot sleep in the boat. It's just a single boat. It's a very, very tough job. So if you can find other alternatives that is not related to the ocean, with the land at this time, then some of them will be very happy to change their way of income and trying to make a living. So then if you look at the land, then what can we do to provide them with some sustainable, environmentally friendly income? And that comes again with organic farmings and so on. There's a lot of alternatives can be developed, ecotourism and so on and so on. For example, to come back with ecotourism, ecotourism is for us a great opportunity, because most of the areas that where we're working used to be dynamite fishing, but not anymore. Well, at least not within 50 kilometers where we're working. The local people really recognize now that if the coral come back and the fish come back, because the fish, if it is only the fish attract people and the corals attract people, then they can also make an income. So that's also starting to get into the people's mind more and more often. We can see it already. And that's a positive sign.
And if people want to learn more about this issue, where should they go?
Definitely can go to our website at endangeredspeciesinternational.org. We have some information about illegal fishing and fish and so on and what we do. And of course, there's tons of information on the web about that. Yeah.
Well, I really appreciate your taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you for taking the time to...
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Pierre Fidenzi, president of Endangered Species International, on its work to protect the forgotten species that most other organizations ignore, such as the Philippine forest turtle. Now, let me play you today's creature call once again and see if you've guessed it correctly. This week's creature call is the sound of a kind of reptile that lives in the hottest, driest areas in Africa, just south of the Sahara Desert. Some of these areas may not get rainfall for years. The animals that make this sound will dig and live in burrows that can be over 20 feet long. They are also the third largest tortoises in the world. Listen to the sound of an African spurred tortoise. Archived episodes of The Wildlife are available on iTunes, at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And, of course, if you have comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com. The Wildlife is generously underwritten by the Lake Champlain Land Trust, a nonprofit organization permanently conserving the lands, lakeshore, critical wildlife habitats, and natural areas of Lake Champlain. More information is available online at lclt.org. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, in Burlington, Vermont.